Welcome to another edition of The List, a Write Fiction podcast. We've got a great show for you all today about our favorite, underappreciated, and overlooked albums. Before we get started, if you love the pod, please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your listening app. It helps us reach new listeners like you. Also, be sure to check out our companion Spotify playlist with all our picks that we mentioned in the pod. The link is in the show details. Now, on to the show. A while back, I saw the Academy Award-winning documentary Searching for Sugar Man, and I thought it was just fascinating. The story is about a guy named Rodriguez who released an album titled Cold Fact in March of 1970, and it ultimately sold poorly and was overlooked in the United States. But miraculously, many years later, this overlooked and underappreciated album sold tons of copies in South Africa, enough to have a documentary made about Rodriguez, which is really crazy. While this is just one instance of an album being overlooked, music lovers out there know that this happens all the time. They can go dig into their vinyl collection, CD collection, or Spotify playlists and see albums that they absolutely adore that just don't get the widespread recognition they feel they truly deserve. As music lovers, these underappreciated and overlooked albums hold a special place in our hearts. We just wish others felt the same way about them as we do. That is what we will be discussing today. We will be discussing our favorite overlooked and underappreciated albums, from Marvin Gaye's In Our Lifetime to Sparks' Kimono My House. We've got the definitive list, so hang out with us for a bit and see if our list matches yours. And with that, on to the show. We got Adam, Freddie, Brendan, and myself. And we're going to kick it off with Adam today. Go ahead, buddy.
All right. Now, these aren't really like 3-1. These are just three very, albums that, that I love and just not enough people love with me. We'll just go with, we'll go with Super Furry Animals, Phantom Power. They are a Welsh band. They had their moment in the sun there. I mean, on the album before this, Paul McCartney was on there doing his celery thing. I mean, they're recognized in the, in the British scene. I saw them a couple times over here, but they never kind of caught on really in the States. And then they've been defunct for 11 years or so, but they just have a great combination. They like had electronic element in their music early on. I think they have just, I like their song craft. They really do it for me. And this album is my favorite of theirs, and just so many songs I love on this one. So I got there, yeah, Super Furry. They got also we've got Bird and the Bee, Ray Gunn's album. My love for the George family does not end at Lowell. His daughter Inara is just, her voice is just blows me away. And her partner in this, Greg Kurstin, is a real player on the scene. I mean, he co-wrote Hello with Adele, which right there makes you financially secure for, many generations. Just from that, but I like the quirkiness of it. They work well together. They've done also a couple of tribute albums of it. They have a whole album of Hall & Oates songs, and they recently just did one of Van Halen. And Kirsten do Eruption on the piano alone is worth the price of admission on that. But the album is of original tunes, and I think there's just a lot of I just melt for her voice every time. So Bird and the Bee. All right, and finally, to round things out, I picked Sparks' Kimono My House. The Ron and Russell Mile, the brothers from L.A., didn't really make it out there and went to Europe and kind of were big there. They've been always kind of ahead of the curve and never really appreciated. Well, it's kind of, the humor is a little out there a bit, but the musicianship is great. And on this album, they actually have one of the few times they have a band, and I think they just... and it's just energy. It's kind of like Queen before Queen, but I guess Queen, had much more international acclaim by, a million miles. But these guys have like 25 albums, are always creative, always great. And this one, actually, Morrissey points to this album as a huge influence of his, the same. They have, like, they're kind of like the musicians. They're definitely worth a look. Even if you don't like this particular album, they evolve into like half a dozen different styles over 50 years, and just They're always going for it. So, but this one's my favorite of theirs. A lot of punch, a lot of glam. So there's my three.
Great picks, man. Hey, Freddie, what do you got, man?
All right. So I'm going to start out with the group called Soul Coughing from the 90s. Their first album, Ruby Vroom. While a lot of people might know of the group and maybe even the album, I don't think they ever really got the acclaim that they deserve. They were one of the first groups to mix sampling with live playing. And just the sounds of the record are so unique. Like, I had never heard a snare drum like that before I heard that album. Yuval Gabay, the drummer, sounded like he was hitting a piece of metal in an industrial factory. Just great, great sounding stuff, great grooves. I'm a big fan of theirs. And the bass player, Sebastian Steinberg, and Mike Dowdy, I mean, they all went on to have pretty good careers past the band, past the life of the band. All right, so that's number one. Number two is a fella named Chris Whitley. Rest in peace. His fourth studio album, Dirt Floor, which is kind of unique because it's basically just him and a guitar and his foot. And it was recorded live to, you know, two track by Craig Street. He's a great producer from New York who has worked with a lot of people. And there's some really cool stuff on here. Some great songs. I've always been a big fan of Chris Whitley. And I actually got to meet him at the Tin Angel. He was not in good shape. And unfortunately, it, you know, took its toll. But man, what a great, great musician. And the third album I have listed, oh, by the way, the Dirt Floor is from the late 90s, released in 98. And then the third album, going back to my 70s roots here, is Heatwave, their second record, Central Heating. Great band, multinational band, because there's people from the States, people from the UK, people from, I think the drummer is from Czechoslovakia. They're from all over the place. And while this album did have a couple of, actually Grooveline was the big hit from this album, I think it kind of paled in comparison to the first record in the terms of quote-unquote hits. And this was the last album that Rod Temperton appeared on before he came to the States and basically hooked up with Quincy Jones. And then the rest is history. I mean, you know, all the Michael Jackson hits right. that he wrote, you know, we all know about that. And that's my list.
Really interesting picks. Some stuff I've never heard of before. And I'm going to go with my list now. And so my number three pick is a woman named Shirley Bassey. Is it Bassey or Bassey?
Bassey.
Is it Bassey?
Yeah.
So my pick is a woman named Shirley Bassey. And it's her album, Something, released August 1970. A couple key tracks on this one were Spinny Wheel. A lot of people know that song. It's been covered a lot. Originally, it was by Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and their version was terrible. Hers was awesome. The other key track on this record is Light My Fire, originally by The Doors. Also, their version was terrible. Hers is awesome. Yeah, I just love this record. Everybody should know who Shirley Bassey is. She's just amazing, and I'll go to it more a little bit later. My number two pick is this guy, and I'm going to say his name wrong, but it's Anders Osborne and his album called Coming Down, released in 2007. It's a, you know, a stripped down kind of semi-acoustic album. Key tracks on that one are a song called My Old Heart and Oh Katrina. Songwriting is masterful on this record. Instrumentation is spare and awesome. And a really cool thing I like about this record is the use of a sousaphone in the place of bass in many places, which I thought was it's amazing to hear. And my top pick of overlooked and underappreciated albums, which is kind of weird, I guess, but is the Temptations in a Mellow Mood. And the key tracks on this one are What Now My Love and A Taste of Honey, which swings so hard, and the harmonies and background vocals are terrific. This record was released in 1967. It's the sixth studio album of the Temptations. And this kind of, everyone knows the Temptations, and they might know of this record. But this one kind of gets lost in the shuffle of their main hits, My Girl and Losing You and all these ones, Just My Imagination. But nobody that I talked to that, likes that old school soul stuff really looks to this record and is like, hey, what about this record? So that's why I picked it as an overlooked record, even though it did do very well and got them in the Copa. But those are my top three picks, and we'll talk about them a little bit later. But before that, I'm going to go to my buddy Brendan. What are your picks, man?
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. I'm going to try to go in some sort of rank. So I'm going to start with number three. And my third pick is by an artist named His Golden Messenger, who is really one guy, and he's often accompanied by a band. But on this record, it's a solo effort. His name is MC Taylor. And so this record is called Bad Debt, came out in 2010. It's an early work for him. It was done on like a tape machine, a cassette recorder, I believe. So you can hear that. But his whole aesthetic is just super interesting for me. It's like Southern Gothic folk music. There's lots of imagery. There's a lot of sadness in the songs, and you feel that. And I really dig his voice. I think his guitar playing is understated and interesting, and the song structures are just they're very satisfying to me. My second pick is a group called Hiatus Coyote, and the album I picked is Talk Tomahawk, which is their debut full-length record, came out in 2012. And the first time I heard it, I was like, where did they come from? Like, what is this? Turns out they come from Australia. And when I heard it, I couldn't stop listening to it. And to me, it sounded like music from the future. And I don't know if that makes sense, but that was like my first impression, or the future of music, one of those two. It's like, it just had this combination of being hip, but also catchy. And so like, for me, that kind of checks a lot of boxes. So that's my number two. And my number one most overlooked album, which I think is the definition of overlooked, is Marvin Gaye, In Our Lifetime. And this is from 1981. I think this is his second to last album that he ever put out. And it's interesting because everyone knows Marvin Gaye, but a lot of people don't know this record. And it's certainly a problematic record, but it's awesome. He was really upset. This was his last record before he broke it off with Motown, because Motown went in after the fact and did a lot of changes to it that he didn't approve of, which I think was quite upsetting to him. And so you can hear a little bit of disjointedness across the record, but the grooves are amazing. If you listen to Heavy Love Affair, that makes the whole record worth it, in my opinion. And I think vocally, he's right there. It's got influences of like just the right amount of disco influence without being too much, but it's still very much R&B and in its prime, or well, maybe not in its prime, but R&B in the early 80s. I mean, I think it encompasses that sound really well. And those are my picks.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back shortly with some discussion about all these great picks. We'll be back. And we are back. Freddie, I want to hear more about your pick. So one thing that was really surprising about one of your picks, Soul Coughing, was one, I didn't think that was you. I thought actually that was Brendan's pick. And to find out it was you, it was kind of like surprising to me, especially when I listened to it. One, I didn't really get it, didn't like it, but the bass was awesome on it. So tell me a little bit more about that pick and why, you know, that pick meant something to you.
I guess it was like a time when I was searching for some new music to listen to, and these guys came out, and I was really taken by that rhythm section. Yuval Gabay and Sebastian Steinberg, which leads me to kind of a tie-in with Chris Whitley. I went to see Chris Whitley at the Khyber Pass. He was touring on his third album, Din of Ecstasy. And just so happens, his rhythm section was the bass player and drummer from
Wow.
Yeah. And I got to say, it was one of the loudest things I've ever heard in my life. It was so loud. Basically, it was Chris Whitley playing, like, I think he was playing an old acoustic slide guitar through a stack of Marshalls. What? Yeah. And Sebastian was playing through an SVT. It was just super, super loud. I had to run towards the back of the room. It was so loud.
That's pretty interesting.
It was a great show.
That's pretty interesting because when I heard that Chris Whitley album, I really enjoyed it. I thought, wow, man, this is like right up my alley. It's like great songwriting, but like dirty. But like I was like, oh, this is wonderful. And then I was thinking, I don't really know much about him. So I was like, oh, in my head, I'm like, oh, this is a guy. He does like little things, acoustic type things. And to hear that he went and just like blasted out like that, it's really interesting. Now I got to check out more.
It must have been the Soul Coughing influence, because all those records, I didn't know this one, but I know Soul Coughing, and the bass is always hot. I mean, it's like those records sound like 90s hip hop records with respect to the bass, or at least the early Roots records where they had an upright player. Like, it just was very much sonically on par with that.
Yeah. I thought for sure that was you, Brendan. I was like, this has got to be Brendan.
Well, I liked Dan, but I didn't know this one.
And the Soul Coughing backbeats almost remind me kind of another Philly guy, G Love. It kind of has that, like, a little bit of hip hop edge to it. Yeah.
I can hear that.
Yeah. And then your other pick, Freddie, Heat Wave. I'm proud that I know a lot about, you know, soul music and old soul music from my pops and stuff. And this album of Heat Waves, I never really got into it, but there's some interesting stuff. I really dig the ballads on it, especially one thing.
Star of the Story. Oh, man, there's some of
the ballads and when they do the harmonies, and oh man, that's really great stuff. One thing I couldn't get into though was the disco thing is just like a lot.
That was,
man,
the times, I guess. What was it? When did this record come out? 78.
Right in the heart.
So when you listen to it, do you cringe when you hear the real disco thing, or are you like, oh, shooky, that's my shit right there?
Yeah. I think I'm able to take what I want and leave the rest, as they say.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. I hear you in that.
I had the same reaction. Some of that record, I was like, yeah, okay. But the disco parts, I was like, ooh, maybe that didn't age so well.
Yeah, it didn't.
Yeah,
it didn't.
It's like really, really, really weird.
Well, I can throw my disco albums pick away. Yeah. Your top three disco albums. We'll just not do that podcast.
We'll skip that.
and so, Adam, thinking about like records that were made in the past. You know, I'm thinking about your album Sparks, and I actually had interesting feeling about that one, and also I'm listening to His Cold Messenger. It's for Brendan's pick, and my take on them when I listened to them on the Spotify playlist was that at first listen, I didn't like Sparks because I was like, oh, this is just some hipster dude that came out. This album came out like you know, 3 years ago, and these guys are just a bunch of hipsters, and they're just doing this retro thing, and it just sucks. And then I listened to the His Golden Messenger thing, and I was like, oh, man, this is so authentic. This is, I can't believe they just really went there in back in the day, and it's just so authentic. And then when I did my research on them and found out that the Sparks was came out like a long time ago, and His Golden Messenger came out recently, I had the exact opposite feeling. I was like, all right, F this, His Golden Messenger and Sparks. Oh man, you guys are really ahead of the game here. I gotta check out more your discography. Did you guys have a similar feeling about that stuff, or does it matter, like other people's picks and like the timing of them? And did you have a kind of similar feeling, or am I just crazy?
Well, I think when we're getting to this, you know, getting down to the micro, when we're talking about albums like this and stuff, I mean, history and timing does matter on a lot of it. I mean, maybe not to your overall like of it, but you can't discount, you know, how ahead of time things are, or like the context of what was available at the time. But I didn't really feel that way about His Golden Messenger. I like that kind of, you know, retro approach to the album. I mean, with Sparks, I mean, I know Sparks is kind of known for always just kind of being a little ahead of the curve and never recognized, because they, like, this was kind of like, you know, British glam was kind of a huge thing. And then my record club's in an extensive study of that time period, and Sparks actually had to go over there to be big. And then they kind of, if you look into their, they did a kind of a little disco thing with Giorgio Moroder, and, you know, that's, it's really popular in their catalog, but I don't like it as much. But then they kind of did like a Pet Shop Boys thing before the Pet Shop Boys. And if you keep looking ahead, they're like in their third, you know, creative burst in the mid 2000s, they started like doing experimenting with vocals over percussion. And I mean, they've always just kind of been ahead of the curve, but they're always just kind of like too weird for mainstream consumption, you know?
Hmm.
So I have a question. What came first, Queen or Sparks? Because when I started listening to that Sparks album, I was like, wow, it sounds a lot like Queen influenced anyway, the harmonies and the classical, you know, progression. I'm a little confused there. Queen debuted in 70. I'm looking it up right now. This album came out in 74. So is there some kind of crossover, do you think? What do you think, Adam?
It was right around the same, almost at the same time, and they were both in that British scene. So I think there had to be like a little cross pollination. I can't say for sure. I mean, if you look at the Queen, look, the first couple of Queen albums are not incredible.
They're not Queen albums.
They're not glammy.
Yeah, they're like the first couple of Queen albums are right. Not Queen.
Queen too, like inspired Guns and Roses. You know what I mean? And so by the time, but I think, I mean, maybe I'm just my bias towards, because I've done an extensive study on all of Sparks' albums, but I think they were kind of,
right.
I think they kind of influenced a little bit more, maybe. And yeah, kind of like Roxy Music was in that time as well, with the kind of bombast and Diamond Bowie. I mean, Ziggy Stardust was right around that time too, in that 73-74.
Right.
And I think Queen ran with it, you know, to a much greater extent. And you know, I mean, Freddie Mercury is Freddie Mercury. But I think Sparks is like that band that you saw, you know, in town. But then it's like someone took that idea and ran with it more. I mean, did they deserve all the credit? Gotcha. No. Did they deserve more than they get? Of course, because that's why I picked them.
Right on.
Way to stand by your pick, man.
Cool.
Hey, Brendan, I got to go to you now, man.
Bring it.
And this is also, is probably for Brendan and Freddie, at least from what I understand of your tastes and likings. But so guys, this Hiatus Coyote thing, I've been trying to figure out a way into them. So if this is an underappreciated album or overlooked album, in your opinion, How can I find my way in? Because you know, you guys know me. I love melody, vocals. I don't know. I like certain things, I guess. But for some reason, I can't find my way in. So as your pick, Brendan, how can I find my way in?
Yeah, this may be a little bit of a struggle for you. Just from what I know about your tastes, you tend to like productions that are a little cleaner than where they usually go. So I think that may be a little bit of a barrier for you. I definitely get it. I mean, I've put this record on at times when I'm not in the mood for it, and then I didn't know until I figured out I was not in the mood for it, because I don't know. I think it demands something of the listener that is not everyone's thing. And it's interesting. I sort of thought you would go for them based on what I know about your taste, but I'm also not surprised that you didn't thinking about it. So mm-hmm. I don't know. You could try the second record, you know, and that's kind of part of the reason I picked them, was because they came out and there was a bit of a splash. So it's not like they were overlooked in that case. They were nominated for like a Grammy, I think, but they kind of, I thought they were going to go a certain trajectory, and they kind of haven't. So that's why I feel like they're a little overlooked.
Hmm. And like, so if you break the aspects down, is it just like the whole thing do you like, or is it just like the arrangements, or like the quirky, you know, quirky stuff they do sonically, or is it the lead vocals, vocals? Is there something about it that you specifically are, you know, are drawn to in that respect?
Yeah, for me, it's a lot of it comes down to the experimentation within the groove. Their sense of time phrasing, I think, is interesting to me. I think the textures they use are pretty bold and courageous in a lot of ways. And I think her melodies sit nicely on top, because if you didn't have that, it's almost like they would be a prog band if you didn't have her sense of melody on top.
It is an interesting mix of taste. Yeah.
Is that something you're into, Adam? Are you into that band at all?
Yeah, I mean, as my extensive studies as a over the top music junkie go, I can never take the first listen at face value. The first listen for me is like personal downloading. You know what I mean? And given we had a short window of this, they still pique my interest quite a bit. And also I find it, I just want to throw this little tidbit in, because just it was a quite of a glut of new stuff this time around that a lot of us didn't know. Is I find it interesting that the more I over the top like something the first time, it never seems to hit that mark ever again for me. It's really interesting. With this, yeah, I don't quite have an ear for it yet, but the one point I did want to make on this is the lead vocals almost remind me of a dead ringer of like the vocal treatment on Amy Winehouse's Frank. I don't know why. I mean, it ties me there all the way. Maybe it is the melodic devices she's using there. I don't know if it's probably not the treatment itself. I think it's maybe just the melody cadences remind me of Frank a lot.
I could see that.
I think it's also her use of vibrato.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Go.
Yeah, which I do not like. Anyhow.
I just want to add real quickly that, you know, when I first heard them, I was kind of surprised that they weren't from the States.
Same.
You know what I mean? They're from Australia. And what I recall, I think when the first album came out, they were really young. I think they're a really young band. And I'm just coming to find out that they later, like Erykah Badu and Prince, were among their biggest fans. So they got endorsed early on by a lot of high profile musicians, right. And that helped elevate their visibility,
right?
As it will,
right?
So,
which can be hard to maintain, you know?
Yeah. And that was part of my inclusion. They seem to have faded since then. And I think that's not that fair. Because as I said, to me, it sounded like, in many ways, the future of music.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of another, recent band, Mr. Adam, the Bird and the Bee, and kind of what you were saying a little earlier, like, you know, sometimes when you really like something at first and then that fades. Uh-huh. When I listened to The Bird and the Bee and that album, really all of their stuff, but in the first listen, I'm like, oh yeah, that's cool. That's like tasty. And then I listened to it like again, and I'm like, this is so terrible. Like, it's like so cutesy. Tell me I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
Well, we'll see you next week, guys.
Yeah, there we go.
What about them really gets to you, man?
It's the voice. It's really Inara George's voice. Love it. But I mean, I can almost kind of agree with it. I mean, the shortcomings of it is that they are just a duo. And that's not a fleshed out full band. And that's really probably why they haven't blown up. Also, like, Greg Kurstin is busy producing, like, the Adele, he's produced like some Beck stuff. Like, he's a man about town, you know? And it's just kind of like a pet project. Yeah. But it's just like, I just really like what they do. But it only goes so far with the duo. I mean, you talk about power trios, that's right. One thing, but like, it's not a full fleshed out band. And I've heard people live and they just do it as a duo. And as much as I like that stuff, the ceiling is not as high with that configuration. So I'm not going to say you're wrong. Really.
Right,
I can see where you're coming from. I just have a very unflappable bias to the George bloodline.
That's good.
Hey, that makes
sure. Sense. I saw them do a free at noon. Uh-huh. And it was a little, you had to pay attention, you know, and they were actually using some like drum machine loops on a couple tunes, which is never a big boost in my book,
but that's
whatever you got to do to get the job done, you know? Yeah. She can sing and they're both really talented. Yes,
but
so.
Undeniably sugary, but for me, like, I had the opposite thing there, and I sort of was off of it at first, and then it sunk in for me, and I let the sugar wash over me and bathe in it, and I enjoyed it. But I do want to say one thing that is apropos of nothing. There are two references to ray guns on our list, this album, and then one of the Soul Coughing tunes has a ray gun reference, and I just thought we should take a moment to appreciate that.
Ray gun.
Yeah.
Unintentional serendipity.
Synchronicity.
So I don't want to be immune to your opinions. So one of my picks that I was kind of I thought not everyone digs is Shirley Bassey. Do you guys have any thoughts on her as like or that album as like a performer or album, or are you guys not familiar with her? Any takes on that? What do you think, Adam?
I think she's got an amazing voice. Booming voice, just, you know, it's out there. The arrangements are good. When it comes to, at the end of the day, she's a performer. She walks up and sings the songs on the sheet, you know, and it's great. It has its place. But stuff like that, my place, quote unquote, for it is a little more of a narrower spot. That's like I'm having a glass of wine like at dusk, and just kind of, you know, it kind of reminded me a little away and of like kind of like another touch of Schmilson in the night. It's kind of a, you know, collection of favorites with some strings and a great voice. But I have to say. I have to say, like, her voice alone, oh my God. But like all the other arrangements and stuff, it's cool. Not knocking my socks off.
I would like to add that I first became aware of her through her singing, I believe, Goldfinger, the theme to James Bond song. So that's her big claim to fame.
Yep. And Diamonds Are Forever.
But I want to say the song choices on this album are pretty amazing.
Yeah, they're really good.
Fool on the Hill, You and I. I mean, she, whoever A&R did the A&R for this album, put together some incredible songs for her to sing.
To me, she is the anti Nina Simone. She's like everything like Nina Simone is like not, and I absolutely love it. There's a whole bunch of her that like about her music that normally if somebody else that's not her that did this, I would trash it like so hard. For some reason, the elements and the way it comes together is just, I don't know, for me it just really hits home. Yeah. And how about my other pick? I have three picks, but I know you guys aren't going to say anything bad about The Temptations. So I'll talk about the other one.
One moment.
Really? You got something bad to say about The Temptations in the mellow mood?
No, I actually loved, I grew up on that album. I love that album. When I was a kid, I wanted to be in The Temptations. I used to cut school. I used to come home from, because I lived around the corner from the elementary school that I went to. I used to come home for lunch, tell my mom that I had a stomach ache when I knew the Temps were going to be on the Mike Douglas show. So I didn't have to go back go to school.
Nice.
And just thinking about Paul Williams singing The Impossible Dream, I'm getting goosebumps.
I know.
Okay.
So Brendan,
I love
Freddie,
that
I think
album.
Brendan has something to tell you.
I thought he was joking.
I'm sorry, guys.
He's not a jokester.
This is serious stuff. So serious. It was really interesting because Aaron, the Shirley Bassey, I thank you for, because I only knew her from the James Bond stuff. Didn't know she had this career outside of that. And I think it's a lovely record. I think it's really interesting. She owns those tunes that are not hers, which is the best you can ask for any singer. And the arrangements are cool and interesting. And then I saw that you put a Temptations record on there that I didn't know. And I was so excited. And then I listened to it and it was like, it's not that it's bad. It's just that it sounds like they're trying to do a thing to get more sort of highbrow respect, maybe like crossing into
the Copa. Yeah. To get in the Copa and get a white audience.
Yeah. It doesn't do it for me. I don't know. The arrangements are like, it's not that it's uninteresting for me. I just think they're operating out of their wheelhouse. That was very evident to me and it just didn't connect.
So can I just say something real quick? Adam, do you have your hand up?
No, Freddie, get him, Freddie. Okay. Get him, Freddie.
I'm getting the popcorn ready.
All right. So, you know, when I was younger and this was happening in real time, me and my friends' older brothers, they're the ones who turned me on to all the great music that I grew up listening to. James Brown, Live at the Apollo, you know, Temptations, Sing Smokey, like all this great music. When this record came out, we embraced it only because it was different. Like our parents loved Sinatra and Tony Bennett and Nat King Cole. And we were like, well, now our guys are singing this kind of stuff. I mean, I think their version of Hello, Young Lovers is amazing.
It's so,
so you know, just different strokes for different folks.
Click on that, yeah.
That's all. That's all. Yeah, it had to be there.
I get it. I'll recognize that.
Yeah.
And I recognize that, too. I totally
that you
relate
don't get
to
it,
what...
Brendan.
No. I recognize what you're feeling. I'm not canceling your feeling.
Feel free.
No, absolutely not.
All right, to take a different tact, you know, Adam, I really love that Super Furry Animals record. Oh, no. I've never heard them ever. And, tell me a little bit more about them and the music that they make, because I never heard about them and they're fantastic.
Yeah, they're a Welsh band from, I think their first album was maybe 95, and they were a little more like glamish early on, and then they really got a hold of the studio. But like the keyboard player, I'm going to say his name wrong because it's like Cian Ciaran, he was always kind of like a DJ as well, so they kind of like brought early like elements of electronic in. And what, there was kind of a thing In Welsh culture, because they first started, before major albums, they were all Welsh, and then they wanted to get bigger, so they started singing in English, and that's kind of like a bugaboo in the Welsh scene, because it's just like, you're going against our culture. You're going normal for all of that, you know. But eventually they did kind of blow up in the London scene, and they did make, actually, I think it's their 1, 2, 3, their fourth album actually is in all Welsh, and it's a beautiful album. I'm not even going to bother trying to enunciate it, but they really, it's funny. It's that they had their moment in the sun in Britain, and the kind of, you know, they were really popular there, but just never caught on in the States. But I think where they got their production chops, funny thing, their third album, Gorilla, they did at Peter Gabriel's studio. And if you ever heard about his studio, he used to have these big, like these like music camps with a bunch of bands over a bunch of weeks, that all these collaborative things. No secret, I'm a huge Gabriel fan, and Gabriel didn't have any hand in the album, but having they were kind of just given the keys to the studio for the album Gorilla, and gained a lot of studio chops. And then this album, Phantom Power, came two albums later, and they really kind of as you can see, that their studio chops are just out of hand on it, and they survived a few more albums after that. I saw them twice. The first time I saw them was at the Starland Ballroom. It's like that roller skating rink at like 9th and Spring Garden, and it was for the tour of their last album. It was really great. I find their mix of stuff great, because they mix in the electronic and the and just like this glammy kind of versatility. I'd say
they're a little jammy, aren't they? I got a little jammy vibes from it.
A little bit, yeah. Oh, also, there is an album out there. I think it's called Under the Influence, where they like kind of show what their influences were. And a big one, if you're familiar with the Beach Boys' Surf's Up, which an album I love so much. It's like that was a huge like template for what they did.
I just got to make a real quick disclaimer. Correct myself here. The Impossible Dream, that was David Ruffin singing the lead, not Paul Williams. Sorry. Next.
Yeah, and
feel free to edit that out or not.
That's Dan. Brendan, Marvin Gaye's In Our Lifetime.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah, man. I never listened to this album. And I feel a little bit similar to the Heat Wave one, where it's like the kind of the disco-y or time, you know, stamp of it kind of turns me off. But there's like some other things. There's a couple of songs in there where I'm like, oh yeah, he's doing the thing that he was kind of doing in a couple of his early records, where the band has like a killer groove and he's just doing his Marvin Gaye thing. And I was like, yeah. But part of me thinks with this record, and maybe it's because the band, the record label wanted to took it or did some other stuff to it. This is the record for me in my head where I think about Marvin Gaye, where, all right, this is the record where he needs to take a right-hand turn or something, or a left-hand turn to do something way different. And maybe, you just didn't get the opportunity. But tell me a little bit about why this was especially your top pick.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I think if he had his way, and of course we'll never know, I think that's, he wanted to keep pushing it further and further. I think he wanted to take that turn, and it seems as though Motown reined it in as much as they were able to under their power at the time. And yeah, I agree. I just think for me, it's a little bit disco. It's not too much disco for me. It doesn't turn me off, but it embraces a little bit of the sound of the time. And I think it shows enough progression and maturity and command, I think, of what's happening. I think there's not a lot of poetry on the record to say that, like lyrically, it's pretty much all about sex, and it's pretty overtly all about sex, but the grooves are great and his voice is as good as ever, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought also, lyrically, I was like, I need something, man. If I want to hear you talk about sex, man, I'll listen to, not Let's Get It On, but the one after that. I'll listen to that record.
No,
that's garbage. the other one. But like after, was it after the dance? After the dance. But yeah, it was very interesting. I need to dig into it a little bit a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm looking at it as like, a lot of us thought we knew, you know, all knew Marvin Gaye, and this is kind of like how this was like an O for everybody. Like all of us were like, what? This is an album?
Yeah.
I kind of see it. It's like bonus material for me, because you know it's like the Marvin Gaye known love is still there, and it's just like you can plug a couple of these extra ones in. And I'm a bit of a completist, and I this is pretty much, as you said before, this is almost like textbook definition of overlooked. You're like, oh shit, this is an album, you know? Yeah.
And it did really poorly. It was overlooked when it came out.
Was it 81?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it competing with in 81? Yeah. I don't know.
So we're getting down to the end here, guys. But before we get out of here, I wanted to see if you guys had any honorable mentions that you'd like to kind of throw out there that didn't make your top three list. What do you think, Freddie?
I didn't really even think about anything past the initial three, did I? Yes, I did have an album on there, and I got rid of it. Mandrill's first album.
Oh, Mandrill. Yeah, I dig that.
The first record was a double record. They were very ambitious. Yeah. And there was really no, I don't think, quote-unquote hits on it.
Right.
Until later with Fence Walk and Ape
Is High.
They
were a good band, though.
Great band.
I dig that. How about you, Brandon?
Yeah, I actually had one that I really wanted to include, but it wasn't on Spotify, which is strange. Mm. So I wanted to stick to our format of being able to share these albums with everyone and keeping it on Spotify. But the one that I really should have been on my list is a record by the producer John Bryan. It's, as far as I know, his only solo record. It's called Meaningless. It came out. Mm. So what's interesting about it, it was released in between him doing the score for Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love. And so he sort of shimmies the solo record out in between. It came out in 2001. And it's really great. It is like pop perfection. The playing is great. The songwriting is awesome. It's got Jim Keltner and Ben Montench on it. And it's like no one knows about this record. And it's not on Spotify. I think you can get it on other platforms, but it's that one has always been a close one for me.
Wow, I'll check that one out. What about you, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, I there's always a handful on the cusp, but one that almost made the grade, and maybe it didn't make the grade because I was the three artists I pick all have like bodies of work that I like that I I think is overlooked is but. This guy only had a little bit, but Bobby Charles, his first album is he's a New Orleans guy, and he kind of teamed up. Rick Danko produced this album. It's just self-titled from like the early 70s, and it's got this. It takes my love of the New Orleans swamp sound and combines it with my love of the band, and just that album just soothes my soul. It's a fantastic record.
Yeah, so I heard that one. It's really good.
Yeah.
It's definitely really good.
And I think it's overlooked. I think us nerds know it, but it could use a little touch of love.
Yeah, I hear that. Yeah, I would say my honorable mention album, and the only reason it didn't make this my list was because I can't have like someone being on it twice. It's the solo record from Eddie Kendricks, released in May 1972. It's called People Hold On. And I don't know if you ever heard this one, but it is awesome. Girl, You Need a Change of Mind. That song is so smashingly killer. Let Me Run Into Your Heart. Oh, man. That album's killer. So if you haven't heard it, I couldn't put like two Temptation related album, on the list.
You could.
The reason I put that on there is because, I mean, I guess in a lot of soul circles or whatnot, that album, people might know it, but that doesn't come out as like one of the albums by one of the people. Probably because he's, wasn't a Temptations, and everybody's like, oh, that Temptations guy. So that's my honorable mention today. Before we get out of here, is there anything else about any picks or any Anything else you guys, you know, are thinking about, you wanted to share about your picks or somebody else's picks before we get out of here? What do you think, Adam?
No, I think I really enjoyed this exercise. And for disclosure, I chose this subject as a, you know, we can talk about our, you know, we're like, yes, the Beatles are good. We get that. I wanted to make it more personal, dig into, you know, and I do feel like I found a window into all of your respective souls.
Yeah.
Now get out.
Let me in.
This was a great topic. It really stretched me personally. And thank you guys for your picks. I have exactly one album from each of you that I enjoyed.
Tell everybody what it is, Brandon.
For you, it was the Shirley Bassey. And for Adam, it was the Bird and the Bee. And for Freddie, it was the Soul Coughing.
Makes sense.
It's a playlist that will stick around because I have a lot more digging to do in all these. So
yeah.
I feel like this is a topic we might revisit down the road. But right for right now, I think that is it. Thank you guys for listening to the List A Right Fiction podcast, and be on the lookout for the next episode that it will be hitting your feeds on Friday. Until then, we will talk to you later. Right Fiction.